Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Now, in an ordinary week, I would be telling you that our weekly conversations include you and the phone lines are open. But tonight, to bring you this conversation, we are recorded. So the phone lines will have to wait until next week. Maybe this is the year for you. Your last, maybe your only child left for college, and it's been a quiet few weeks around your house. Every year there's a new crop of empty nesters, but that doesn't seem to matter much when suddenly it's your turn. All those thoughts of where did the years go can make even the sunniest personality a little blue, while others may get downright maudlin. But there's plenty of hope. Hey, your kid could take up residence with you for months, maybe years following college, or even after a divorce. Meanwhile, you're an empty nester right now, and we've got some help. Dr. Martin Johnson is back. He's a clinical psychologist and director of the Hawaii Center for Psychology. And tonight we're joined by Hawaii Pacific University Assistant Professor Howard Markowitz. He runs the graduate internship program and has worked in family community centers. And they both have a bit of help for the rest of us who become empty nesters. Thanks so much for coming tonight.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Now, we've had a lot of discussion, and every year it seems this is a perennial discussion of what happens with the latest crop of empty nesters. And do we know any more? Does it become any easier? Does it really become any easier, Martin?
I think the only way it can become easier, Beth Ann, is if it's not yours.
True enough.
And I'm the parent of an only child, and I'm a late parent, so I've got several years to go. So I know a little bit about it academically. I know about it from my experience of working with people in therapy, and we'll see how well I do when my turn comes.
Mm. Howard?
Well, I think we have to define empty nesters, first of all. Empty nesters tend to be about my age or a little younger, baby boomer generations.
They can't see you, Howard. You going to fess up how old you are or give us a range?
Well, we're talking about, say, anywhere from about 45 to about 60 years old. And we're talking about people who have then children who are as old as their late 20s or even 30 years old or so, and as young as 18 years old. So I think that's probably the demographics we're talking about here.
That demographic is quaking in its boots at the moment, thinking about what do you do? Because on the face of it, it sounds like you suddenly get this new lease on life, and there are so many things you can do without checking schedules and where people have to be when and who needs what for when. And buying all those school supplies suddenly disappears, although if you're sending a child to college, the school supplies can be more costly. But there can be a tremendous sense of feeling that there is a whole new world about to open up, and then there's also the fear that accompanies it. What happens first?
Well, I think generally speaking, people think of empty nesters in negative terms. That is that there was once a full household and somehow there is less than that, and that means that somehow you have less of a life. And in some cases, in most cases, most, I think, empty nesters or most parents are very happy to be where they are. They have a job, they have work, they have their families, their extended families, they have their life outside of the home and so forth, and now they feel as if they can do what they always wanted to do.
Unless maybe they've got older parents they have to take care of too.
True.
So does that become easier to deal with?
Well, I agree with Professor Markowitz that a lot of times the loss comes first. There's been a pattern of at least 18 years of raising this child or these children, and now they go out the door. And so that's a whole way of being and a way of interacting and a whole set of family dynamics that changes. And so for many parents, there's that sense of loss and simultaneously and sort of paradoxically, this sort of looking forward to sort of regaining one's own life. And then, as you point out, depending on the family dynamics, there may be grandparents who need attention and caring for, though that may have already occurred. We read a lot about the sandwich generations where people are both in the baby boomer range, raising their own children and also helping to care for their older parent.
For those who are clearly in the sandwich generation, you see your children grow up and become independent people. You're watching grandparents perhaps become more and more dependent. So does that add to the stress?
Sure. I think I think caring for your elderly parents is, as you say, a lot of times there's a diminishing aspect as your parents age and are more infirm and less independent, whereas your children are growing towards independence. The other thing that is really different and very stressful, sometimes for the grandparents as well as the parents, is that the dynamic changes. You've always been the parent to your child. You're still a parent to your child. But as your parent, as your own parents age, you become more the mature, healthy adult who assists in decision-making, who takes more responsibility for care. But that person that you're now caring for is your parent, the one that raised you, the one that taught you right from wrong, the one that, you know, wiped your nose and kept
you
out of trouble.
A few other things.
Yes, right, exactly. And so now it's a strange, for many adults, it feels it's a strange dynamic to be saying, no, Mom, you really shouldn't be spending that money. Or Mom, it's time for you to give up your driver's license. Or you know, sort of imposing your judgment onto their day-to-day lives. And that can be very stressful for folks.
So now you may find yourself without your kids, which brought an element of fun, maybe a lot of anxiety, who knows, into your life. But it was a very different color of anxiety than what you feel toward aging grandparents or parents, depending upon your age. Doesn't make it sound like it's a lot of fun, Howard, to be an empty nester these days.
Well, as I said before, there's a real positive side to it, because there may be a real positive side to it, because you find yourself being able to leave the bedroom door open, so to speak. You find yourself being able...
No more Vaseline on the door, right?
Right. And in the evening, you can go to bed, and typically you think about your child, but your child may be away, and you don't have to think what time they're coming home exactly. I mean, you think about it, but you don't listen for it because they're not living there. I think the positive aspects may outweigh some of the negative aspects of being a empty nester. Now you think that maybe I have time to do the things that I wanted to do. It's possible that with the children away, that it's possible to spend that time thinking of other things and considering things that you wanted to do that you didn't have time for now that your child is away.
When you get groups of people together, empty nesters, do you find that the mothers have a very different reaction than the fathers? Because we know that in parenting styles, that very much plays into how a child will be parented, whether it's opposite-sex parent or same-sex parent, and what that that dynamic looks like between a mom and a dad, and that old point about, oh, you know, mom takes it to heart so much more than dad does. But that's not true, necessarily.
I think there is a difference. And I think the difference comes about when you look at what midlife means to a man or a woman, a mother or a father. For many women, it may be that it's a time that they can return to work after a time of raising the kids and taking the time to dedicate nearly a couple of decades, to raising a child. So now it may be a positive avenue, a positive opportunity. And maybe I can go back to school. Maybe I can go back and do a hobby that I haven't considered for quite some time. For the men, for fathers, it may be business as usual in those terms. So I think it's very different. I think you have to ask yourself what midlife means to both men and women. I think midlife has changed. It's definitely, the 40s is definitely different than it was in the 1970s. Being 40 years old is definitely a different. It's the new 30s, let's say, and being 30 is the new 20s. So everything has sort of shifted, not only the demographics, but the culture has shifted.
And most people tend to think that they are acting or feeling younger than they are. Some studies have said as much as 10 years younger, which seems to support that.
Yeah.
What do you see when you talk to moms and dads who are empty nesters, and what differences you see them experiencing?
Well, I think that, and there's some truth to most stereotypes, that moms sort of take it harder at first, and that for dads it might be business as usual. But I also see a lot of variation. I see dads that are sort of surprised by sort of how protective they feel, and now the child is outside of their realm, and they feel like they're unable to be protective. I see people going back to work. I see people opening new chapters. And I think when I see people struggling with it, it's largely that they're reluctant to sort of let go of the chapter that is finished and then turn their eyes to returning to work or re-engaging in an activity or a hobby that either they used to enjoy or they've always wanted to do. There is, especially with middle age being sort of younger than it was a generation or two ago, there's this whole opportunity, especially for those who had their children sort of earlier, to have this whole chapter where they're freer than they've ever been. They're more economically secure. They're more secure personally, interpersonally in who they are. They know what they like, what they don't like. And now they have the freedom and the resources to attend to that and enjoy that. So I agree that for many people, it's a real upside. It's a very positive chapter in life. And as every parent knows, parenting never ends. So they may be outside of your domicile, but they're not outside your heart.
That's all the very good part of it. But if you're looking at how it sits in Hawaii, where we have parents who may have been working, each of them, two jobs already, they've been doing this. So whether mom is going to go back to work or be able to maybe increase hours or focus more attention on the career may be the question. But given the fact that we have the tendency to have more jobs, each of us, to be able to make life happen in Hawaii, is that an added component when you become an empty nester that you start to consider a little differently?
Well, I think that in Hawaii, there is an atypical number of households that are multi-generational. So we kind of are different than the mainland in that way, than the national average. So a lot more people in the home. I think it's like 4.5 people in the home compared to a single family, a nuclear family of 2.3 or whatever it is. So I think that the multi-generational family, there's some advantage to that. At least it sounds like there's an advantage. When you have more people under one roof, you have more people contributing, you can keep a closer eye on people, on the children and so forth. But it does lend itself to a certain amount of problems, conflicts too. A lot of financial conflicts, because surprisingly, multi-generational families hover around the poverty line more so than regular families, nuclear families. So that's an issue to be aware of.
Depending on the age of those people in the family, if you have a lot of people who are working, then not so much. But if you have elders who are no longer working and now a salary has to be split four ways instead of two ways, you've inherited that too, plus...
Or if somebody's unemployed, or if a child had to move back home, say they went back to the university and then things didn't work out, or there was a crisis of some sort and they came home, that puts an extra burden on the midlife parent.
I think another thing that happens locally a fair amount, we're talking about the empty nester, but I think for a lot of families here in Hawaii, so the kid graduates high school and goes to college. And maybe they go to UH or one of the other satellite campuses or HPU, but they live home still. So there's really not an empty nest. And some of that's financial and some of that's just sort of local culture. And some of that's just the way some of our universities are sort of set up, that they're sort of commuter campuses as well as having some dormitories. So not everybody actually goes through that empty nest, especially locally. And I think that's sort of nice to acknowledge as we're sort of talking to the public here.
So whenever there's a commuter college, there's certainly a segment of the population that, for better or worse, has a child staying at home to attend college. But that means you have to change your way of being and how you relate to that kid, because it's no longer, hey, you know, I was waiting up until 2:30. Where the heck were you? When a kid is 19 or 20 and having to let go in a very different way, and yet be very aware when that person is coming in or about to leave the house.
Of course, this is something that's expected in some families. I mean, we know there are cultural relevances here. It's expected in some Asian families, for example, amongst Asian Americans.
What's the it?
Pardon?
What's the it that is expected?
That you stay close to home for a certain period of time, that you're really not an individual. You're not really an individual entity until you can make your own decisions, until you can make your own money, and so forth. And that you're expected to just stay and support the family as much as possible. This is very common, for example, in Europe amongst Southern Europeans, Italians, Spanish. They stay home for forever, for the entire decade of the 20s. It's really typical to do that. There's even a term, I think it's called mama's boy or mamani or something of that nature. And this signifies the difference that we place on this period of time between the 20s and the 30s. That decade seems to be treated very differently, and it seems to really evolve into something of a kind of developmental stage unto itself that we call the emerging adult. In other words, you're not quite an adult, and you're not certainly not an adolescent, but you're acting as if you're kind of an adult. And it's that, and even that decade has its own stages. It's kind of the, as you described before, somebody who is going away to school or starting school, they're sort of launching into that decade of emerging adulthood. And it's an exploratory stage.
Go ahead, Marty, go ahead.
Coming off that, it really is a somewhat, not completely uniquely, but somewhat uniquely American expectation, mm-hmm. the rugged individualist, the cowboy who goes west, that kids reach a certain magical age, 18, and mm-hmm. boy, howdy, you drop them off at college, and they're on their own from then on. And again, in Hawaii, there's many cultures and South Pacific Islanders, Asian Americans, where that's not always the expectation and maybe never was in the family the expectation. So I think the empty nest syndrome is really different according to what your cultural expectations are. If you always expected that, then that sounds great. It's the next thing in line. If that wasn't what you ever thought, if that wasn't what your experience was growing up, then I think it's even more of an adjustment. And similarly, the return home after college. When you read the American magazine press, they talk about things like failure to launch. That's not exactly a very positive way of looking at this. And I think, as Dr. Markowitz says, in Europe and in other cultures, there'd be no such thing. It's just like, well, of course, well, you've done this, and now you're home, and now you'll do this other thing, and you'll get on in life, and that's fine. But again, if the expectation is once I drop you at college, you're on your own, and you know we'll visit on holidays and talk on the phone, and then they end up back in your home, well, you know that's a very different experience than a family who had that cultural expectation in the first place.
Cultural and generational, too, because depending upon what you were taught as you grew up, wherever you were, it's normal or it's not normal. But for a lot of people who see life as being, you know, this one timeline. You do this, then you do that, and you just simply move along. There isn't sort of any backstops with it or changes to it. It seems to be defying the way in which they believe life should progress, that someone should be out there. Does this mean that really we need to readjust how we look at that decade between the 20s and 30s, especially now that we've gotten so much brain science that tells us that we don't really have a fully formed person till somewhere around 25 or 26. And the brain and the judgment and the seat of reason that only begins to really crystallize at that point. And maybe we need to readjust how we look at an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old.
Mm. Yeah. The research sort of suggests that there are universal kind of truths that people have about being independent, being an adult. And it really, I think if you understand it, you understand that more in terms of processes, that becoming independent, making your own decisions, being financially responsible, and so forth, are processes. It's not just getting married, and it's not just living in your own, buying a house or having a child anymore. That's a significant marker for being an independent adult. So when you look at the generation that we're talking about, the boomerang generation, and boomerang incidentally means that you've left the house and now you're coming
back.
So a lot of parents know, they don't just sense, they know that these three truths, let's say, of being financially independent, making your own decisions, and being autonomous, are not really accomplished. They take work. They take time. And this is the time, this is the decade in which this happens. And it's very different from my generation, from the baby boomer generation. The baby boomer generation was a generation that believed that when you turned 20, 21, you were expected really to take the next step, which was to get married, get a job, and so forth, and then have a child by the time you're 30 or something of that nature. But that's changed. The time of the decade of 20 to 30 approximately is a time of exploration. And going to college is sort of a launching point. Going to get further education, going to get training and so forth is sort of the launching pad and the launching trajectory for getting that job. And we understand that it's going to take some time. And
it's okay to circle back?
And it's okay to circle back. Right, that's right.
Or even expected that you will do.
A lot of people end up doing it just out of sheer economics. I mean, this is, families have kind of taken it upon themselves to create their own anti-poverty program, and that is, let's live as a family together for a few more years. It makes perfect sense.
The other thing I think is this is all in a context of greater variability in terms of what's considered to be normal or acceptable. Right, we have kids at 18 getting some technical training and launching themselves. We have people staying home, going to community college, then going on to graduate training, then staying home while they start their practice. There's all this variability. Divorce is more common. Divorce is another reason why sometimes people boomerang, at least temporarily. All of these options are available to people. And people are availing themselves of it. We can all sort of think in our own Rolodex of personal acquaintances and go, oh, yeah, I know somebody who did that, and I know somebody's doing this. And all of it, none of it stands out as like, well, that's weird. All of it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. Oh, well, good for them. Good luck with that. Everybody does it differently. And so there's not, especially, I'm a baby boomer too, I'll out myself on air, there's not this sort of lockstep expectation about how life is supposed to unfold. And so when we have people leaving the parental home and returning the parental home. I know of some cases where they've left again and returned again. There's not as much of a sense of right and wrong as there used to be, which leaves a lot more freedom and a lot more variability in terms of what people actually do.
And that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And maybe why we need not to just look at, a 28-year-old living at home, working as a barista, as being, someone who is failing to launch or having an extended adolescence, but just really a time that needs to happen and unfold in that way. And hopefully mom and pop can get hip to the fact that they just need a little longer or they need something more and not castigate the kid for it. But if the guy were 40, it would be a different story. But I want to go back to how we're changing how we look at norms, because in Europe it's also common for kids to have a gap year after what we would say is high school ends. And that concept has been moving ever steadily into the American consciousness, to where it's not so strange when you hear someone actually say the words gap year anymore, meaning that a kid is not going to go right to college right after high school, but in fact taking a little time to do something else that's meaningful, whether it's working or going off to be part of a project or be in a different country or working on, something of importance, and then taking that experience to launch into college too, which all of this seems to suggest that we need to look at those years of, teenage years through the 20s very, very differently, even from the way that we may be looking at it right now. Mm. Or is this just my fantasy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you're absolutely right, Bethann. I think that the 20s are when you launch, as I said before, and when you begin to explore. So once you begin your life after receiving your education, your undergraduate education, in the United States anyway, there's an expectation that you'll be exploring, that you will take a job as a barista, as you say. That you will take a job that is not really in line with what you studied for, but it's a way in which to gain experience.
Yeah, life experience and experience
right.
In a workplace working with people you don't know and you're thrown
exactly.
in with.
Exactly, exactly. And this is true for all fronts, social fronts, economic fronts, making your own money, learning how to take care of a home with roommates and so forth. It may be exploration of social relationships and intimacy and so forth. I mean, this, by the way, scares a lot of parents. The fact that you can, that most people do have, are exploring in their social relationships and their financial duties and so forth, worries people. And I think for good reason, because they may find themselves in a crisis situation, and parents are naturally worried about that. So I think you're right. The gap year is a response probably to something that's already happening in our culture, and that is that the 20s are a time for exploration.
Another thing is I think the gap year is today an adaptive response and a set of skills that people are going to increasingly need to know how to do, because we're in a world where a young person in their 20s now is expected to change careers, not jobs, careers, 5 and 6 times over the course of their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so there are often these little gaps. I'm also involved in training psychologists, and there's often this gap of they've trained so hard 6, 7 years to become a licensed psychologist, but now they've got to wait and take the test and wait for the process to come through that they get a license, and then they can begin to look for a job. And that gap can be 6 months or so. And I actually often do say, go get a job serving coffee. Go get a job doing something fun. It's never going to make your resume, and it doesn't really matter. You've been working really hard. Go do some fun stuff that'll, you know, get you health benefits and enough money that you can feed yourself, and just play, because pretty soon you're not going to be playing. You're going to be playing for real. So there's oftentimes these sort of gaps. We saw it in the last recession as people got displaced out of jobs that they thought were permanent, careers that they thought were locked in, and now they have to reinvent themselves. And so in those gap years are places for exploration, getting back in touch with what you really want to do. We see lots of people changing careers in midlife, even in their 60s, where they do their second or third career, and it's based on kind of knowing who you are, knowing what matters to you, knowing what your needs are. Sometimes it's driven by purely economic necessity, but oftentimes we sort of shape it by following our interests and following our passions. And that's increasingly a reality, not just, you know, it does formulate in your 20s, as you say, but then throughout life it sort of continues.
It sets a pattern for later on.
And it's increasingly a necessary pattern in today's economy.
Which I'm glad you brought up money, because recently I talked with a young man who got into some fabulous law schools. And when he sat down after the joy had ebbed and realized how much he was going to be indebted after attending one of these law schools, he decided, you know, I'm not going to go now. I'm going to defer, and I'm going to stockpile some money over the next couple of years, and then I'll go. Now, some would say that might just make him a better attorney if he actually goes through law school or whatever he does, because he's done it in a very mindful way, and he has a couple of years to mature even more. Do you think that that's consistent with some of the kids that you talk to?
It's consistent with what I see. You know, the graduate students that I deal with, probably more than half of them have taken significant time between their finishing their bachelor's degree and going on to graduate study. And, you know, for myself, psychology is a second career. So I see people, what used to be called non-traditional students, and I see more and more of them, and I don't hear that term so much.
Right.
Because that sort of is increasingly the norm. And some of them are retooling. They already had another profession. I know several psychologists that were attorneys before they were psychologists, and then they went back, and vice versa. So, I think putting things – I don't even think it's putting things off. I think it's sort of living life a bit and then creating a focus is increasingly what I see.
Yeah, I would say on the other end, with regards to 20-year-olds in that decade, 20 to 30-year-olds, this is a time of exploration. This means that most people do have a base in which to fall, or a safety net in which to fall back on. So if you're going to make a mistake, if you're going to choose the wrong career, if you're going to zigzag into a career, this is the decade to do it. Necessarily, we find ourselves zigzagging in other decades as well, but this decade is for exploration and for the making mistakes.
Howard, if we know this, though, and clearly the two of you see it, how is it that we don't seem to tell them this when we are their parents? Like, I know you're going to zig around. I know that you're going to explore. I know that you're looking for something that really does it for you. We seem to have this expectation still that they should know, because maybe we don't want them to waste our money when they're going to school and study something that they're not going to ever use. But we seem to know a lot about the brain, about kids, about the time it takes for a childhood really to end and an adolescence to end. But we don't seem to translate that into how we talk to our kids a lot. There still seems to be these expectations that they're going to be more linear than maybe we know they should be.
I don't know.
You know, I was just going to cut in. I think what you're at the heart of what you're talking about, Beth Ann, is the difference between, and I experience it as both a parent and as a psychologist. I can sit with somebody else's family and, oh, it's very, very clear to me what needs to happen. And I can be very calm and very reassuring as I encourage the parent through what it is they need to do. And then I turn around on my own family and it's my kids sitting there and I've got a whole other set of pulls, right? It's one thing to be a coach. It's another thing to be the player. And so, sure, we know things all the time, but as parents, you know, that's our love and our joy, and that's our we're totally invested in this person here, this child that is ours. And the anxiety runs high. We want only the best for this child, and to remember that the best for this child is to sort of back off and let them be and let them fumble around and discover and let them skin their knee and pick themselves up. I think for many parents, and I'll opt to that myself, is a difficult thing to remember.
Yeah. There have been times when, as a parent, I've had to walk out of a room because I'm afraid I'm going to say something.
And that's probably wise.
Until I end up saying it anyway, in which case I've completely shot to you-know-where then. But that goes back to the point about do as I say and not as I do kind of thing. This idea that somehow we separate what we really know from what we're encouraging a child to do or how we want to raise that child. And sometimes that puts a burden on a kid.
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of times we are motivated and we act out of our feelings, out of our emotions.
And fear, particularly.
Fear, particularly, but also love and passion. And so the more emotionally connected we are, the more emotionally involved we are in a decision, the harder it is to sometimes sort of sit back and be fully rational, right, and sort of be Mr. Spock about it. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. But I think that's really what we're dealing with. It's like sometimes we know what we want to do, and yet when we're involved emotionally and we're sort of caught up in it, the emotion sort of guide pulls us along. And later on we go, I probably shouldn't have said that. Or, I now that I think about it, maybe I should have just been quiet.
And for an empty nester who's just coping with having a child go off to college, to know that all these other layered emotions may be bubbling up to the surface, that sounds like it's a lot to be dealing with, not nearly as carefree and easy as maybe, you know, everyone would like to have us believe. That becomes sort of another myth. Is that really something that we should sort of myth bust a little too?
Well, I think we have to step back as parents, but to allow autonomy to sort of emerge from our kids. I mean, that's what they want. And that's what we expect of them, autonomy. But I think we have to stay connected as well. And I think as parents, I think I can speak for a generation here, baby boomers. We've stayed very connected with our children. Some would say
Obsessively so.
And we have terms like the helicopter parent and so forth. But I think this has been good for the most part, from what I see from my students anyway, both undergraduate and graduate. They are more self-confident for it. They have a certain sense of self-esteem, and they have certain knowledge. And I think it comes from staying in touch staying in touch with parents and having a relationship with their parents that I never had with my World War II parent generation. So I think that's the difference. I think we are seeing a generation in the boomerangs, if we can call them that, that is very different than when I grew up in my generation. I think that really makes a big difference. But the point is that I think for parents in general, if I was to give one piece of advice, and that is to step back as much as you can, but stay connected. Mm-hmm. And that's whether they're living at home or not living at home. Of course, when they're living at home, it's going to be more difficult to try to achieve, as you say, stepping back and yet staying connected, because our children will make mistakes. There will be critical moments when they do come home late and drunk, when they do have a crisis situation, perhaps getting arrested or substance abuse or whatever it is. Then we have to modify the step back and stay connected, mm-hmm. and we have to be more vigilant.
That's quite a dance to
yes,
do when you're trying to stay connected and yet stay out of their hair enough to where they feel as if they're independent. Easier done, as you say, mm-hmm. if somebody is farther away from you. But then there comes the issue of, well, how much contact should you have? What are your expectations about phone calls? A friend of mine told me that when he was dropping off his son to school, that one of the counselors there said, you want to make sure your kid calls you, get a card that has, you know, the money part of it that you would put money in, and just send the card. And said, here's a little something for you to have fun. He said, the kid will call and say, what happened to the money? You know, it's really a tough thing for a parent, because you want your kid to want to talk to you, not just call you because they're looking at you as the benefactor.
Well, I think another complicating factor to what Howard's talking about is that, and every kid will be different, even within the same family.
Mm-hmm. Especially within the same family.
Right, right. And so what was a wonderful balance for one child may be over leaning forward or over leaning back for the other child. And so just as out of compassion for parents, that this is going to always be an ongoing struggle, and nobody's ever going to get it perfect, and it doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be, you know, both of those in the both the staying connected and the leaning out and allowing autonomy. But, you know, the other piece that you're talking about, Beth, I think is I think it's important to recognize there's two sets of needs, right? There's the child going off to college and their need to be in touch with you. And then there's a parental need, you know, to be in touch with the child.
And for an empty nester, that's kind of the place to start.
Sometimes, yes, exactly. And like anything else, that's a negotiation. That's a negotiation. And finding at this age, you know, most young adults, students, are at a place where they can begin to have some fun with the parent, where it can sort of be needs can be on the table and negotiated in a jovial and friendly sort of way. That it doesn't have to become sort of a nagging sort of a power dynamic, but rather just just an acknowledgement that, hey, I really miss you, and you know, I didn't hear from you last week at all. So, you know, cut me a break here and you know, pick up that smartphone that I gave you and you know, say hello once in a while.
Well, when you said about the smartphone, that also means that perhaps parents have to get better about communicating to kids in a way that kids like to be communicated with. Texting. You know, there are a lot of folks that, I don't want to be bothered with that. You know, just call me. But there are a lot of, you know, kids who are off to school and they can shoot you a quick text, which is at least some acknowledgement that they're communicating with you in a preferred fashion, and not necessarily picking up the phone to call you unless there's something really that needs to be discussed, as opposed to a hi, how are you?
And then there are some kids where texting is their world, and for the parent to begin texting them seems an intrusion. I think Twitter and Instagram benefited greatly by the baby boomer generations getting on Facebook and friending their kids. All of a sudden, Facebook wasn't so cool anymore, and the kids had to scramble to some other sort of, if not secretive, sort of more exclusive form of generational communication.
Or just lock you out and not friend you anymore.
Oh, hopefully not. That would be harsh.
But that does happen. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes that has been the result of knowing too much about your kid, and then a kid not feeling that he or she has a private life, which doesn't feed into that feeling of being an autonomous person. And that goes back to, Howard, what you were saying about trying to create a sense of connectedness to a child, but also enough space to where they can feel that they can grow into their own adulthood and not even be emerging, but just growing into that first stage.
Right. In particular, for the child who's returned home, the boomerang generation that we referred to before, that child probably is wants to be treated as an adult, and parents probably would like to treat them like an adult, but sometimes there are conflicts. Returning home to your old bedroom that still has your toys, your baseball bat, your Barbie dolls, and so forth, and there you are with your older, emerging adult at home, and he drops his or she drops her duffel bag off and places a mess and coming home late and having other friends over and so forth. I think parents really have to go into this with both eyes wide open, that they're and they have to be honest with themselves, and they have to be honest with their emerging adult son or daughter, that there has to be a plan. You can't just return home and expect this to be your home for how long, for example. You have to have a plan. You have to talk about this, and this is where the emerging adult has to begin to be expected to act like an adult and talk to them about finances, talk to them about having children over, their friends over, talk to them about staying up late and I might come home late and so forth and so on. There's lots to kind of talk about and to plan. That's part of being an adult. So if you're moving back home and you're paying the mortgage or you're paying the rent, you have to be able to talk to that emerging adult in those terms, in adult terms. That's part of being an adult. A lot of parents may hesitate because they think it's too aggressive or they think it's too forceful. They don't know, perhaps. And I think you have to use your good intuition, a parental intuition here. It makes sense to talk to your child about this because they are taking up space. They are using the heat. They are using the AC. They are using these
things.
They're
costing you. That's the bottom line.
And they have to know this, and they have to pitch in. Now, a lot of families, this happens already. But in some families, they need to have this conversation because it is an unusual, atypical kind of experience in other generations. Now it's more common.
That's a very, very important point, because my experience is that both parties have their own set of expectations about what's going to change and what stays the same. So, for instance, the parent might expect that what stays the same is that this is my roof, it's my rules, and the house is quiet by 9:30. The returning adult child may have expectations like, well, there's food in the fridge all the time, and mom cooks every night, and yeah, I'll do the dishes once in a while, but dad's car is there for me to drive, and yeah, of course I'm not paying rent. So everybody has their own set of expectations. The adult child wants to be treated like an adult, but they're not thinking through, and that's why this conversation and negotiation is really so important, because everybody's going to assume that the things that they want to change are changing, and the things that work in their favor, no need. And that's where a lot of conflict sort of shows up. Again, I want to make one more point, which is I think it varies greatly with the expectations and culture of the family, right? I think for some families, this sort of multi-generational living is an expectation and just the way it's sort of always worked. And so there's maybe less need for this explicit negotiation. And for other families, it's like, no, wait a minute. We got to think this out. We got to talk it through. But one way or another, that has to get communicated so that the shift is equitable on both sides.
That's pretty difficult for a lot of parents. And it can be very difficult for kids, too, if they're hearing, mom's going to charge me rent? Are you kidding? This is my room. That sense of what belongs to a kid, a child, and what belongs to the parent, that line is awfully fuzzy.
But it can be negotiated, and there are many ways to cut the pie. I mean, to many perspectives on this. It could be a contribution of a check, or it could be in exchange of bartering for taking grandma and grandpa to the hospital, to doing the chores. It could be anything. So it doesn't have to be paying rent. It can be negotiated in any way. The important point is, are you part of the ohana? And I think in a traditional sense, among traditional families, this is, as Martin just described, this is sort of something you don't have to explain to people. People rarely do. It just happens. You have to do these things. But in other families, it has to be made more explicit. Another thing I'll say that is what when you do make these adult-adult communications, these times for communications, you begin to find out more about your son or daughter's schedules. You begin to find out about what is the what kind of burdens, what kind of commitments they have, and so forth. You begin to detect maybe some things that are going very well in their lives and some things that are not going very well. So having a plan really brings up all sorts of things. It's an avenue to other areas. Not that you should be looking to explore these in any detail, but giving with distance, staying connected, and staying connected and stepping back again is the key.
I hear you saying that some of this sort of comes in the window when you're having a conversation about one thing, you're going to find out about a lot of others. And as long as you're not too much of a nosy Parker about it, you may get a lot more insight into your child.
Yes.
Now, remember, though, when we all first had kids and they were babies and we had a bunch of other parents with us who were also having babies and there was baby hooey and there were all these ways in which we were able to network so that we were able to experience this whole new phase of life together. What happens at this phase? Are there other places where we can go to where we can support each other in that kind of way, or somehow do we outgrow that, or at least think we do?
Well, I don't know if we outgrow it, but I think, as I was saying before, there's so many different greater variability about how this transpires that we may or may not be around other families that are having parallel experiences. I think the other thing is, as we grow older, our willingness and capacity, well, I don't know if it's capacity, but our willingness and just our thoughtfulness about creating new friendships, creating new common bonds, and seeking out others in a similar circumstance, it seems certainly less than it was, say, in our 20s or in our 30s or when many people were starting to have their kids. So I think a lot of families do handle this more in isolation or just within their own family. And I think I'm glad we're talking about this today, because for a lot of people, especially the people that I talk to as patients, they're experiencing stress in these changes and they feel quite alone in it. And it doesn't look like what they saw in the movies. It doesn't look like what they experienced growing up themselves. And so they're having some challenges negotiating it. And I think that's a very good point. They don't have the baby hooey. They don't have the empty nest parent hooey. Although that's an idea. You could probably start a club and do really well with that.
Is there a way, though, of being able to make that okay for parents? Because somehow we get a little older and we think, well, we should be able to handle this and we know so much more. How do we make it okay to say, yeah, well, maybe we need to have an empty nest or hooey and be able to discuss some of these feelings that may just come out in casual conversations with family and friends and coworkers, and suddenly realize that there is some commonality here and that this is worthy of being addressed and having a little fun with it, too?
I'm willing to bet that if we, whipped out the laptop and searched Yahoo groups, that there is already a support group for empty nesters. And I was being somewhat facetious, but actually I think that is a good idea, that there be support for people going through these sorts of life changes because there are commonalities. And I think it's also reassuring even when it's different. It's like, oh, wow, that family's doing something that I would never do. It seems like it's working for them, good for them, but oh, okay, it makes me feel better about how I'm now going to handle my connectedness and yet backing away for autonomy. Because, again, I think Dr. Markowitz has done a good job of pulling out that dynamic that's so important, but then how that balances out for each family and for each child is so unique. And so I think parents in their 40s and 50s and who are going through this do often sort of feel up in the air about, am I doing this right? Is this the way it's supposed to happen? Am I supposed to be arguing with my 25-year-old about dirty socks on the floor?
To say nothing of the girl that he brought home last night.
Yes, or that either.
Yeah, well, I would harken back to the midlife trajectory that most people are on, if we're assuming that people in their 40s and 50s are becoming more committed or in a different career trajectory, for example, and they're becoming more and more involved in work, more and more involved with social obligations, outside groups and so forth. They're going to meet people. I mean, it's just you have to couple the idea of finding solace with other parents, couple it with other kinds of activities that parents are involved in.
How about just some fun?
Yeah, it could be anything. It could be a softball league. It could be music, whatever it is. Because in your 40s and 50s and 60s, you begin to try things that you haven't tried. I mean, this is a time where you begin that more years are behind you than in front of you, and you want to do certain things, and you want to be around other people who want to do certain things. So it sort of coincides and has to be looked at, this idea of finding camaraderie with other parents, looked at as coupled with where you are in the midlife trajectory, the developmental process.
And being discerning because of it.
Yes, yes. Discerning in the sense that now you're really going to commit to things that really matter to you. Mm-hmm. You're going to go in that second career because you have time to do that. You're no longer directly involved with your children as much as you were. It's not so hands-on. So you have that kind of time to do that, to begin to. And that naturally begins to change the way your relationships are structured and your life is structured with friends and family and so forth.
So as empty nesters do this, they're in effect, though, becoming models for their kids for later on, whether they realize it or not, because all of this is changing so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would bring up one other thing, and that is when children are home, and I just wanted to make sure we got to this point, too. When children are living at home, parents in general have a better sense of what they're getting involved with, whereas people, the emerging adult who's at a college and whatever, don't have that same sense. So,
well, be more specific about that. What do you mean by getting involved with what?
Well, when the emerging adult is, for example, involved with maybe they're drinking too much.
So you're talking about risky behaviors.
Right. Or maybe they're going from one intimate relationship to another, and parents feel that there's a crisis coming on. I think it's important to be with other people and to talk about that it's a possibility that could be a crisis point in a person's life. Not all people land on their feet, I guess is what I'm saying. Not all people go through the exploration stage. They're going to be the rare cases which people experience alcoholism, for example, unhappy relationships, and so forth. So unemployment, losing their job, disappointments along the way. And this can reel a person into depression or worse than that. And it's very hard sometimes for parents to be able to delineate that fine line between what is normal behavior, what is just a crisis, and what is possibly a pathological behavior.
One thing that I do tell parents, and I tell parents from newborn all the way to, you know, adult children in their 30s and 40s, is what's very useful and what research shows works is a combination of high warmth and high structure. And then the structure is the part that needs to keep backing off, right? A three-year-old requires extremely high structure. It doesn't have to be harsh structure, just clear expectations, and so that they know they can anticipate what's going to happen. If we do this, this is what's going to happen. And then by the time you get to teenage years, there still needs to be some structure, but certainly not what a three-year-old has. Somebody in their 20s, less so, but again, predictable. Again, negotiated. Again, a conversation and a clear sense of a role in the ohana. And so that high degree of warmth, and within that, some communication, whether it's explicit or implicit, and then also some structure in terms of predictability. Those things work, and it gives room for it to show up in all kinds of styles. But what research shows that if both of those are there, people do okay.
Mm-hmm. You actually have students that you see every day who are mm-hmm. in this same group, this millennial group that we talk about. Mm-hmm. It has a very different way of being than the generations above it. And for their empty nester parents, is that gulf growing wider, or are we actually experiencing some more understanding with all the things that you've talked about today?
I think I think for the most part, our parents, their parents, the emerging adults that I have in my class, classes are benefiting from this, my generation, the baby boomer generation, and that they've developed relationships with their parents that are very, very strong and very, very much a model for what they want to be.
The boomers with millennials?
Yes, the millennial. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think the they understand that the TV, the media presents rare cases, outlier kind of cases, that this is these are unusual, and that the very real kinds of models in their lives are their parents or the people that they know. I think parents are doing a fantastic job. And the research sort of suggests that there's great respect for, in both ways, running both ways and bidirectionally, mm-hmm. that the emerging adult has for their parents and the parents have their emerging adult children.
So while parenting hasn't gotten any easier, maybe there are rewards that are deepening on both sides?
I think so. I think this is, at least from my experience and from, as I said, the research suggests that there is a closeness and a respect intergenerationally between these generations that might have been absent in previous generations.
I would have to agree, too. You don't hear quite as much about the generation gap. I don't hear anyone in their 20s saying, I won't trust anyone over the age of 30 anymore.
Like the 60s generation?
Right, yes, right. So a lot of us growing up. While there's wide variance and people sometimes still have problems, and that'll always be with us, but I agree that this generation has much more respect, maybe perhaps not expressed always in the same formality that previous generations had, but more of a real respect for who that person is that happens to be my mom or my dad. And I think it does go both ways. I see that as well.
Well, we're coming to the end of the hour. Just as we're capping all of this discussion, what would you say would be the big takeaway for this year's crop of empty nesters?
I'd say, be appreciative of the chapter that's coming to an end and close it up with fond memories, and then be really open to how you want to explore this next chapter, how you want to stay connected to your child, how you and perhaps your spouse, if, assuming the spouses are still together, want to explore this together and how you're going to model this for your kids and make the most out of this next chapter.
Thank you. Howard Markowitz, a final thought from you.
I would say parents, empty nesters, have to decide what they want to get involved with as far as their children's lives are concerned, to choose to be involved is rather difficult, as you described before. It's sort of a dance you have to play. But staying connected and stepping back at the same time is probably the most important thing I think you can do for children, for the emerging adult child.
And maybe for the empty nesters, we need some fun.
I agree.
Not a bad thing. Howard Markowitz and Martin Johnson, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us tonight for Town Square. Next week, we will be back live. The phone lines will be open, and we'll be here waiting for you. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.